Well, at long last, after an entire year, I'm finally going to conclude this study on Satan and his epic war with God. There was probably about a six-month sabbatical in there, but the study was started a year ago, next Sunday, I think it was. And we've made it the whole way down to the end. Last Sunday, you remember we talked about the man of sin / the false prophet / the second beast, which I showed to be one and the same personage, as far as I can tell. And we saw that the beast in Revelation 13 was put into place, and that happened near the end of time, and that the false prophet and the beast were compelling men to worship the beast. And now we're going to get to the image of the beast in Revelation 13 and verse 14, which the man of sin / false prophet / second beast deceives the wicked into making. Revelation 13 and verse 14. It says, "And deceiveth them," this is speaking of that second beast, "and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by the sword and did live." Then this man gives life to the image of the beast, however that works, and he compels the world to worship him. And we see that in the next verse, in verse 15. "And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed." And I don't really have a lot to say about what the image of the beast is. I don't know if it's a natural physical thing. Given that the book of Revelation is signified, it certainly wouldn't have to be. I don't know, King Nebuchadnezzar made a great big image and he made men to worship it, so there certainly is precedent in the scripture for a physical image. And if it is a natural thing, then it wouldn't be any great feat to make it talk and speak with the technology that we have today, of course. So I don't really, that's about all I have to say about that, so I don't know if I really added any value to your understanding of the image of the beast or not, but that's about all I know. I guess whenever we see the thing set up, then we'll know more about it. So then that brings us to the false prophet, second beast, man of sin, causing the reprobate to worship or to receive the mark of the beast and then to worship the beast. And we read that in the next verse in Revelation 13 and verse 16. "And he," that is this second beast, "and he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, bond and free, to receive a mark in their right hand and in their foreheads." So we see that nobody's getting, or very few people anyway, no class of people, let me put it that way, no class of people are getting out of receiving the mark. It doesn't matter if you're rich or you're poor or you're a slave or you're a free man or, you know, anything about you there. All types of people are going to receive this mark. It says in their hands and in their foreheads. And before I get into what I would just use the word guess, because that's about all it amounts to, so you can take it for whatever that's worth. But before I get into my guess as to what the mark of the beast is, I just want to give you some facts about the mark of the beast. These things are all 100% true, and then we get into my guess, then you can weigh that on your own. So first of all, the mark is received into the right hand or in the forehead. We saw that in verse 16. But remember, once again, Revelation is signified, so that doesn't necessarily mean that it's actually a mark, a physical marking, on your right hand or across your forehead. I suppose it's possible that people could walk around with some big mark on their forehead. That'd be kind of weird. So more than likely, it's probably something speaking here symbolically, that the mark is symbolically on your hand or your forehead, and that's what I'm going to get into whenever I tell you what I believe it could be. Then secondly, it's needed to buy or sell, and if you don't have it, you're not going to be able to do commerce. Verse 17, "And that no man might buy or sell, save that he had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name." So you got to have at least one of these things. You got to have the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name, and these things are all definitely tied together in some way. And if you don't have them, you're basically shut off from doing business in this world. And that could be quite the affliction and tribulation if you can't buy or sell anything, obviously. So this is clearly a satanic plot to force people to take the mark. Because when you give most people the option, okay, starve to death or just take this nice little mark and worship me, most people, you know, I'm not talking about people in this room. If I'm just talking about people in the world, they're going to say, well, whatever. You know, I'll take the mark. I'm not going to starve. I'm not going to let my kids starve, right? I'll do whatever I have to do. And that's what most people are going to do. The mark of the beast is associated with the name of the beast and the number of his name. We just saw that in verse 17. And we're exhorted to count the number of the beast, verse 18. It says, here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. So we're supposed to count the number. And it is the number of a man. We just saw that. And the number is 666. So that's pretty much what we know about the mark of the beast, that number there. And now I'm going to give you what my best guess is. First of all, I'll just give you some other people's guesses. I'm not going to go into detail about them, but some people believe this was the Roman Emperor Nero, that he was the beast and the mark was his face on all the coins. And if you didn't, you know, if you wouldn't use his coins, you couldn't buy or sell and so on. You know, if you didn't bow the knee to the emperor, then you're going to be in trouble. I don't believe that is the proper interpretation of this, because as I showed last Sunday, that the setting of this, I believe, is right near the end of time. And furthermore, if you think about it, in Revelation 17, we read about the six kingdoms, right? Five are fallen, one is, the other's yet to come, and then you got the eighth, which is of the seven. So you got eight world empires, and John said at the time, by the way, at the time, either that Nero was living or Nero was already dead. Nero died in 68 AD. So more, I tend to agree with that Revelation was written after 70 AD. It was written in the 90s is what the consensus is. But anyway, even if it was written before 70 AD, Nero died in 68. So he died before 70 AD anyway. So to try to put the mark of the beast there, I don't see that fitting. And so, but you have these kingdoms. So anyway, getting back to that, in Revelation 17, five are fallen, one is, and I already showed you, the one that was the Roman Empire. You got Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, the Greeks is five, and then the Roman Empire is the sixth, and that was the one that was reigning at the time when Revelation was written. And then you have another king, another beast that is yet to come, and then an eighth after that. Well, this mark of the beast in Revelation 13 is happening in that last kingdom. And that's not the kingdom of Nero, right? I mean, Rome was long gone, and then there were other, you know, at least two other kingdoms that come after that. So anyway, I don't believe that Nero was the beast, the mark of the beast, for those reasons. Some people think that barcodes are the mark of the beast. And you go online, you start looking around. I mean, it makes some interesting points. I guess if you look at the barcode, you got this big bar on the left and big bar on the right and then this bar in the middle, and the width of those bars equates to a number. So that's how a barcode works. It scans the width of the bars and then it assigns each of those a number, and that's how they can identify the different products with the UPC code. Well, anyway, that bar on the left and the right in the middle equals 6 is what I've read and been shown online anyway. So you got 666. And if you don't have the code, the barcode, you can't buy or sell and so on. So people make that argument too. I don't buy it, but they make that argument. RFID chips, a lot of people are making much of this because nowadays RFID is radio frequency identification, and it's the little chip that they are now inserting into people's hands. So people really make a big deal about that because it's in the hand and they put it underneath the skin. And it's like I don't know if any of you have worked for big corporations, but they'll give you a card a lot of times and you walk up and you put the card on the little reader at the door and it unlocks the door. That's an RFID chip, right? So if you got that, you got the mark of the beast. No, just kidding. So anyway, but then the next thing that comes, do you have one at work?
Yeah, well, I have one where I used to work.
Well, he's already got the mark. Watch out for him right there. So anyway, but the next thing that is coming, and people, they are doing this already, is they're putting the little chip underneath your skin so you don't have to carry around the card anymore. You just walk up and, you know, put your hand up against it. And it wouldn't be a great stretch whatsoever to see a day when you're walking up to the grocery store and you just scan your hand and buy your groceries, right? So I can see why people would say, oh, that's the mark of the beast. It could be. I'm not saying it's not, but I'm not convinced that that's what it is. And then you have 666 symbols all over the place. The Star of David, you know, the on the Israeli flag, which is not the Star of David at all. It has nothing to do with David. But that six-sided star, that's a 666 because you got three sides on each triangle. So you got six sides of the two triangles. And then you got the six-sided hexagram in the center of it, which the triangles make. And then you have six triangles on the outside. If you look at it, you know what I'm talking about. So people made that, you know, 666. The OK sign, 666. All right, look at it. 666. Right, you see all the Hollywood weirdos, singers, and Illuminati people, and they all do this thing or they do this. You can go online, just look it up. You'll see it. Anyway, they're always. I'm not saying, hey, I mean, I do this too, and I don't mean anything by it. So, but some people do mean something by it. And when you see them doing this, that's not just my eye is itchy or whatever. You know, I mean, there's a reason they're doing that. The symbol on the New King James Bible is a 666. It's like I'm not even kidding you. You can look it up. It's got. It looks like the. I'd have to show it to you. Anyway, you'll see it. And when you look at it, it's like this three. It's like an oblonged, three oblong symbols together, and they're kind of all interwoven. But if you look at them, 666. So, it's all over the place. I'm not saying any of those things are the mark of the beast, but it certainly seems like the wicked people of this world love to put 666s all over everything. I just saw on Google the other day. Google was, you know, on their main page, they'll change. It just normally says Google in the colorful letters. Well, they'll change that to some kind of an image, which would have something to do with a celebration of a certain day or somebody's birthday or whatever. I don't remember even what the. I think it was St. Patrick's Day or something. Anyway, 666 right on that thing. It was crazy, and I pointed it out to somebody. So, I think they just like to throw it out there. It's kind of like hint, hint, you know, we're of the devil. So anyway, now with all that, I'll give you my best guess as to what I think the mark of the beast is. And it's not as flashy and exciting as all these other things, like people getting chips into their hands and everything. But so here we go. The number 7 is the number of completeness, and it represents completeness. And we can see that in Genesis 2, 1 through 2. God rested on the seventh day after he did his work, after his work was finished. So it is a number representing finishing of work or completeness. Genesis 2, 1 through 2. It says, thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God ended his work, which he had made. And he rested on the seventh day from all his work, which he had made. So the seventh day signifies rest. The work is done, right? It's a number of completeness. That's why we have a 7-day week. Now, 6, on the other hand, is a number of incompleteness and imperfection of man's works. It's the number of a man. Remember, that's what it said there. Revelation 13:18, it said it is the number of a man. And 6 would be, you've almost made it there, but you're not there yet. You haven't reached perfection and completeness. Though you've tried and you get right up to it, but you never can quite reach that level of perfection and completeness. And that, I believe, symbolizes man's works, where man tries to make himself righteous, but he just can't quite get there, despite all of his efforts. The number 666 is repeated 3 times, I believe, to signify that man has been a total failure. So when God repeats himself, there's a reason for it, typically. And I think it was the study that I did on Isaiah 40, the Bible study series a while back, and I think it was maybe the first study where Isaiah starts out that chapter saying, comfort ye, my people. And I went through probably 20 or 30 different places in the Bible where God repeats himself. Jesus says, verily, verily, right? So whenever God says something twice, pay attention. If he says something 3 times, he's really trying to emphasize something and get you to take heed. Like where it says in the prophets, O earth, 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 hear the word of the Lord. So when God says something 3 times, he's emphasizing. So 666, emphasizing man's incompleteness, imperfection of his works to try to attain unto godliness. Now the reprobate trust in their works for salvation. Look at Matthew 7, 22 through 23. And by the way, just so you don't think I made this up on my own, which it'd be fine if I came up with this idea on my own, but I didn't come up with this idea on my own. I think I probably embellished it and added to it. I can't remember exactly now, but I believe it was in one of Philip Morrow's books that I read, probably in Things Which Must Soon Come to Pass, his commentary on Revelation, I'm pretty sure. And he made this point that the 666 represents man's incompleteness in his works. So anyway, and then I think I kind of took it and ran with it, if I remember. I can't remember. I don't remember all the details of that. Anyway, Matthew 7, 22 through 23. It says, "Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have not we prophesied in thy name? And in thy name have cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works. Then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity." So man, wicked men, on Judgment Day are going to go to the throne, and what are they going to tell God? "Look what I did. I did all these good things. I was a good person, and therefore you should accept me because I've done all these wonderful works. I've even cast out devils, right? I've prophesied in thy name." And God says, let me look in the book here. Alphabetic order, he gets down. "Nope, your name's not here. Go to hell." All right, "I don't care about your works. They are filthy rags," right? "You're offering me something really disgusting," which is what a filthy rag was in the Old Testament, something a woman would use once a month. "You're offering me something really disgusting, and you want me to give in exchange for that righteousness and give you a place in heaven forever. No thanks. Go to hell." That's what God says. So works-based religion could therefore be the mark of the beast. Could be. Now, here's one reason why I conclude that. Look at Revelation 14, 9 through 11. And this will bring it together, I think, anyway. Makes sense to me. Revelation 14, 9 through 11. Now, this type of preaching is unlike me. You normally don't hear me get up here and say, "This is my guess. This is what I think. If you don't think so, it's okay. You might have a different idea." That's not normally how I preach, right? The most of the time, I say, "Thus saith the Lord." I give you the verse, and you know, if we're going to disagree, then we're going to disagree, but I'm not going to say you might be right. You know, you could maybe convince me you're right, and then I'll change my mind, but it's not like, "Oh, we're probably both right." No, we're not both right. One of us is wrong, for sure. But in this case, I don't know what it is exactly, so I am giving you my best guess, and you are certainly not bound to share my opinion with me. Revelation 14, 9 through 11. "And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, If any man worship the beast in his image, and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night who worship the beast in his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name." Now, what I want you to notice here is the people that receive the mark are going to hell. They are hell-bound reprobates, right? It's not like one of God's children can accidentally get this thing and then, well, he's okay. No, it says if you receive the mark of the beast, you're going to hell. So that tells me that all the reprobate are going to get it and all of the elect are not going to get it, right? And if it was just some thing where they were injecting into your skin or something and they convinced you to get it, well, are you saying if a child of God was deceived into getting this thing for the convenience of it and he hadn't been paying attention to Revelation or something, that all of a sudden now he's going to the lake of fire and there's no hope for him? Of course not. Because one of God's elect is not going to the lake of fire. Jesus died for his sins and he's not going to the lake of fire, period, no matter what. Right? So that's why I don't believe that it's probably some physical thing, but I believe that it represents works-based religions, man's works, humanistic religion and philosophy. That system is the mark of the beast, is what I believe, and I'm going to go through and continue to give the reasons for that. But so the point is, anyway, you go to Matthew 7, and you see that those that trust in their works go to hell. Then you go here in Revelation 14, you see that those that receive the mark of the beast go to hell. All those that trust in their works, right, and have not the grace of God are going to hell. All those that receive the mark of the beast are going to hell. That's why I'm saying, maybe these two things are fitting together here. Look at Revelation 20, 11 through 15. Revelation 20, 11 through 15. It says, "And I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face The earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, both small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books. Not the book of life, but the books, right? There's these books, and then there's the book of life. So there's different books here. And the dead are judged out of the things written in the books. Those are all their works that are recorded in the books. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them, and they were judged every man according to their works. And death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. When God pulls out the books and he judges men according to their works, they're all going to hell. Now, if you look and God sees your name in the book of life, the other books have nothing, there's no entry in there for you. Because Christ blotted out all your sins. He took away all your sins. So you don't have any works in the books to be judged for. Because your name's in the book of life. So the beast's religion could likely be humanism. And I'm just going to read what I wrote here just so I can say it the way that I wanted to. Those who don't conform to the religion of humanism with its atheistic, feminist, sodomitical, and egalitarian doctrines, who will not worship the government system, the beast, that promotes and enforces them, and therefore do not have the mark, will be cut off from commerce and be killed. And you can see that how that is a plausible explanation. If it's the religion of this world, which is ultimately humanism, right, and we can see the effects and the fruits of humanism in those things that I mentioned, atheism, which is big into humanism, feminism, the sodomite agenda, egalitarianism, where everybody's equal and we have to do whatever we can. You remember that study we did on equality? We have to make everybody equal. We can't judge anybody and blah, blah, blah. And all that whole type system there. And that whole thing is promoted and enforced by the government. And we see that happening now, right? The government is enforcing that type of philosophy on us. And if you don't comply with it, it's already happening. I'm going to talk about that. You are shut out from society if you don't comply with those things. And you're cut off. And eventually, don't be surprised if you'll be killed. Because, you know, we can't have people out there that are bucking the status quo. We can't have people out there that are exposing this wickedness for what it is. These are hateful people, right? These Christians, they're hateful. They hate sodomites. They hate transgenderism. They hate all this. They hate all this wickedness and all this evil, and they speak out against it. And we can't have this. We got to get rid of them. So I can see that happening there. Those who refuse to go along with the system will stick out like a sore thumb or a big stamp on one's forehead, and everybody will be able to see that they don't have the mark. You see, because if you don't go along with the system, and if you don't say, yes, I agree, yes, you know, and parrot whatever you're supposed to say, then you stick out like a sore thumb on your right hand, or like you have it written across your forehead. Like it's very obvious to everybody that this guy is not with the program. He's not with the system. He's got a mark on him, right? This is already happening. Like I said, people have lost their jobs and had their careers ruined for speaking out against it. I don't know if you run in the same circles that I do as far as the types of news and things you listen to, but I hear about this stuff quite frequently, that it's happening all over the place where people are losing their jobs for not... Jordan Peterson, now he didn't lose his job yet. He's a professor up in Canada. He's got a huge following now. This dude makes millions of dollars through Patreon, which is incredible. But anyway, he just basically said, I won't do it. I will not use gender-neutral pronouns. I will not refer to a man as a he or a woman as a she. I won't do it. I'm going to refer to people with pronouns that match their sex, period. I mean, 50 years ago, we'd say, who wouldn't? What in the world? But today, in the universities, that's a big step out. Oh, you won't call somebody by whatever they think they are? You know, I think I'll start identifying as a 70-year-old man, and maybe I can start collecting Social Security now or something. I can just identify. This is what I identify as this. So, you know, where does it end? I mean, goodness. So anyway, Peterson just said he wouldn't do it, and he's got an incredible following now. I don't agree with him on everything, certainly, but it's good to see somebody just putting their foot down. And he was in an interview one time, and they're like, well, but, you know, what will you do if, what if you, I forget what she said, basically, what if they force you to do it or something like that, or what if you end up being put in jail? He's like, I don't care. I'm not going to say it. I won't do it. You put me in jail, I'll go on a hunger strike, right? If you find me, I won't pay it. I just won't do it. And that drives those kind of people crazy because they're not used to seeing somebody that'll just say, you know what, screw you, I'm not doing it. I mean, I personally have fell victim to this in a very small little way. It's not a big deal. I don't think I'm going to be boasting about it when I get to heaven, whenever people are saying, you know, I got sawed in half and, you know, I got crucified and this and that. And I say, well, yeah, well, that's bad, but I got cut off from Airbnb. About that. But anyway, this is just a small sampling of things to come. I was cut off from Airbnb. I used to use that service. I don't know if you know what Airbnb is, but people rent out their houses or rooms in their houses to people that are looking for a place to stay. It's like a hotel type system where people are sharing, you know, their house or their rooms. It's really great. You can get places really cheap, and you're staying in a house instead of a hotel, and it costs less and all that. But anyway, they came out with their new policy regarding the sodomites and the transgenders. And when you log into the app, it says right there on the front, we've changed our terms of service. You must read and accept it. Now, if it was just buried somewhere, I don't read terms of services anyway. Maybe you say I'm crazy, but I got better things to do than read through 10 pages of legalese, which at the end of the day, it pretty much, if you're going to sign up for anything, you're going to have to sign up for it. So either you just pay no attention to them and go about your life, or else you just totally get off the internet and never do anything, because either, you know, it's one position or the other, really. So anyway, I doubt it would hold up in court. I don't think. Anyway, they know that nobody reads the thing. So anyway, that would have been one thing. But when you click OK, then it puts it right in your face and it says, I will not discriminate against anybody for their sexual orientation, for their gender identity, and blah, 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 right there. I mean, one sentence and you have to say OK. And you know what I said? No, I will not go there. I'm not doing that. And because, you know what, I will discriminate. I will not rent a house from a sodomite or a transgender freak, nor would I ever rent my house to one. I'm not doing it. So, no, I'm not going there. And I just won't rent any more Airbnb places myself. Somebody else could rent me one if they want to. I don't care about it. But I'm not. I can't, right? I can't. I didn't sign the thing. And you're kicked off. As soon as you say no, your account's deleted. Done. You're gone. That's just a small taste of things to come, I think. There could very well come a time when most corporations, banks, payment companies like PayPal, and other entities like that will enact policies which will make people consent to the humanistic beast system or be cut off from commerce and not be able to buy or sell. And it's happening already. PayPal is cutting people off, too. There have been organizations out there or people that just say the wrong things online, and PayPal just cuts them off. Patreon. Cutting people off. Patreon's a thing where you can have your fans support you online. Patreon's cutting people off. It's happening left and right. There's a purging out there. You know, all those liberals that love freedom of speech and all that? You know, those people, yeah, they love freedom of speech whenever their points of view weren't popular. But now that their points of view are popular, they don't love freedom of speech anymore, and they want to put the kibosh on that. So anyway, that could be the mark of the beast, and that could be how people are cut off from commerce and not able to buy or sell. I don't know, just my idea. So, at this point, it looks like Satan's pretty much almost won the war. He's got the beast system set up. He's got the image, the mark. He's got total control of the economy. He's got a one-world government, one-world religion, one-world military. And pretty much everybody's in lockstep, except for a few of these pesky little Christians. And he's got the whole world worshiping him. Now, all he needs to do is just eradicate the remaining saints. And war's over. He's thinking that he's just about got it done. So he closes in on the saints of God. And he's just ready to destroy them. And then something happens. The Lord Jesus Christ comes back from heaven. The trumpet blows, the clouds roll away as a scroll, and the jig is up. So Satan he's been loosed. He went out to deceive the nations. He gathers them together. He makes this final assault. This final battle against Jesus Christ, we read about that in Revelation 20:7-8. says, and when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about and the beloved city. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. So just when he thinks he's finally got them, he's surrounded the camp of the saints, you know, the true churches of God, and he's just ready to exterminate them and to get rid of them. And then comes Jesus Christ. And Jesus destroys Satan and his man of sin, false prophet, in 2 Thessalonians with the brightness of his coming. 2 Thessalonians 2, 8 through 9. I can't wait to see that day. I don't know. I'm not sure if I would like to see it while still here on earth, or if I'd rather I'd be gone and in heaven and be watching it from the rafters or what. But anyway, 2 Thessalonians 2, 8 through 9. I mean, it's like the ultimate movie where the bad guy is going to win, and at the last second, something gets turned around and it all comes down crashing on his head. It'd be the greatest movie that's ever made. 2 Thessalonians 2, 8 through 9. It says, And then shall that wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders. So Satan loses this last and final battle with God. Then the Lord's got one more thing to do, and that is to cast Satan into the lake of fire. He had prepared this lake of fire just for Satan and his angels. Look at Matthew 25, verse 41. Matthew 25, 41. It says, Then shall he say also unto them on the left hand, Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. You see, the wicked go to the same place the devil and his angels do. The Lord prepared the lake of fire for them, and the wicked also get to reside there also. Let's read about it in Revelation 20 and verse 10. Revelation 20, 10. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. And at that point, there is no war with the devil anymore. God's war is over with him. Our war is over with him. All of his angels are there with him. There is no more temptation, no more accusation. It's all over. Now, one final thought. This will take just a few minutes. When will the final battle in the epic war be fought? That's the question. So we've talked about everything from the beginning of time to the end of time, but you might wonder, when is this going to happen? When's the final battle going to happen? Well, I can tell you when. It's going to be fought at the second coming of Christ. But that's not going to help much. But I'll show you that first of all. It's going to be fought at the second coming. Revelation 20, 7 through 10, which I've pretty much already read. Or we already read that whole passage there. So that's the second coming, whenever Satan has compassed the camp of the saints about, and then fire comes down from God out of heaven and destroys them. And that happens at the second coming. Let's look at 2 Thessalonians 1, 7 through 9. 2 Thessalonians 7 through 9. Now, there's some things and many things in Revelation, like I said, that are signified and symbolic. But whenever you can take a passage and then compare it with a passage which plainly states the same thing happening in the New Testament, then you can say, okay, yeah, this part of Revelation 20 is literally talking about the second coming of Christ at the last day. Because in 2 Thessalonians, it spells it out. Same thing's going to happen, and it tells us in plain language. 2 Thessalonians 1, 7 through 9, And to you who are troubled, rest with us when the Lord Jesus shall be revealed from heaven with his mighty angels in flaming fire. Remember, fire comes down from God and destroys them. In flaming fire, taking vengeance on them that know not God and that obey not the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, who shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power. He shall be tormented day and night forever and ever, right, in the lake of fire. This is speaking of the exact same thing that Revelation 20 is. Revelation 20, is the last part of it there, is referring to the coming, the second coming of Jesus Christ on the last day and the final judgment of the wicked, where the resurrection happens and all that. And then 2 Thessalonians 2:8-9, we already read that, that the wicked will be destroyed, be consumed with the spirit of his mouth in the brightness of his coming. All right, so this is the second coming of Christ. Okay, so the final battle is going to be fought at the second coming. So then you're going to ask, okay, well, when is the second coming then? I'm really trying to get down to the bottom of this. Well, I can tell you when the second coming is. It's on the last day. Okay, so I'm just revealing more and more things here. I'll prove it to you. Let's look at John 6, 39 and 40. This is like trying to nail jello to a wall here. John 6, 39. Let me just read it. I'm just going to read a string of verses here for you. I'll show you when the second coming is. And this is the Father's will which hath sent me, that of all which he hath given me I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again at the last day. Right? The resurrection is on the last day. Verse 40. And this is the will of him that sent me, that everyone which seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day. Verse 44, no man can come unto me except the Father which has sent me draw him, and I will raise him up at the last day. Verse 54, whoso eateth my flesh and drinketh my blood hath eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. And let me give you one more, John chapter 11 and verse 24. John chapter 11, 24, Martha saith unto him, I know that he shall rise again, that's her brother Lazarus, he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. So the Bible is very plain, five times over, that the resurrection is at the last day, right? And that's whenever Christ comes back, because Christ comes back to resurrect the dead. This isn't in the outline, but let me just give you this one. Look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 16, for the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trump of God, and the dead shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. So when Christ comes back, the dead are going to rise, right? And the dead rise when? At the last day. Right? So Christ comes back on the last day. The resurrection's on the last day. You think, oh, why are you belaboring this point? Because almost everybody doesn't get it. That's why. People think the resurrection of the righteous is either 1,000 years before the last day, or 1,007 years before the last day, if you're a dispensationalist, or it's 3.5 years before the last day, or it's 7 years before the last day, or it's sometime before the last day. Just about everybody's messed up on this. On the last day of time, both the righteous and the wicked are going to be resurrected together. Look at Acts 24 and verse 15. Acts 24, 15. And have hope toward God, which they themselves also allow, that there shall be a resurrection, one, of the dead, both of the just and unjust. There's going to be a resurrection where both just and unjust raise. And let me show you one more, John 5, 28 and 29. John 5, 28 and 29. Marvel not at this, for the hour is coming, in the which all that are in the graves shall hear his voice, and shall come forth, they that have done good unto the resurrection of life, and they that have done evil unto the resurrection of damnation. They shall hear his voice, not his voices, not one voice, you know, now, and another voice 1,000 years from now, when he resurrects the righteous first, and then 1,000 years later resurrects the wicked, or 3.5 years later, 7 years later, whatever. No, one voice, one coming, one resurrection, just and unjust, on the last day. And this resurrection is going to happen at the same time that the heavens are destroyed, on the last day. Let me show you Job 14, 12 through 15. Job 14, 12 through 15. It says, so man lieth down and riseth not till the heavens be no more. They shall not awake nor be raised out of their sleep. This is the sleep of death, right? Man lies down, and when does he rise again? When the heavens are no more. When the heavens and the earth are destroyed, that's when the resurrection happens, right? On the same day. Oh, that thou wouldest hide me in the grave. See, this is what the sleep is. There's sleep in the grave. That thou wouldest keep me secret until thy wrath be past. That thou wouldest appoint me a set time and remember me. If a man die, shall he live again? All the days of my appointed time will I wait till my change come. That's the change of the body that happens at the resurrection. Thou shalt call, and I will answer thee. Like when he called Lazarus, come forth. God's going to do the same thing at the last day. Come forth. Thou shalt call, and I will answer thee. Thou wilt have a desire of the work of thine hands. Okay, so when's the final battle fought? At the second coming. When's the second coming? At the last day. Okay, now what might the next question be? When is the last day? Right? How much longer do we have to wait for the last day? And here is your answer. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. And let me repeat it one more time. Nobody knows when the last day is. Nobody knows when the second coming of Christ is. Nobody knows when the end of the world is. Nobody knows. People have been trying to predict the date of Christ's second coming, his return, for nearly 2,000 years, and they have all failed, and they will always fail. They will continue to fail. And you say, well, wait a minute, maybe somebody could just get it right by guessing. They still failed, right? Even if a man gets lucky and gets the date right, it happened by chance, not by wisdom or knowledge or prophecy, right? So if you get something right by chance, you can't say that you predicted the second coming of Christ, right? You didn't predict it. You just guessed at it, and it just happened to be correct, right? I mean, think about it. If you take 1 million people today, 1 million false prophets, and they all pick a different day, that will take us 2,700 years into the future. Chances are, I'm not sure, but I think Christ will come back in the next 2,700 years. I think it'd probably be a lot less than that. But I think it probably within the next 2,700 years, it would be a safe bet to say that Christ will probably return. Now, if they each pick a different date and Christ does come back on some date, you know, 20, 40, 100 years from now or whatever, some false prophet is going to say, ha, 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 I got it right. I predicted it. No, you're an idiot. You picked some arbitrary number and it just happened to be right. You didn't predict the second coming of Christ at all. Jesus plainly stated that no man knows the day and hour of his return. Look at Matthew 24, 42 through 44. With words like this, why in the world people predict the second coming is beyond me. They just do it time and time again, and they're shown wrong time and time again. And most of them don't even quit. Once they're shown wrong to be a false prophet, then they say, oh, it was an arithmetic error. I did the math wrong. The actual date's, you know, going to be in 3 years from now. What's his name? What's his name? He predicted the end of the world here a few years ago. Forgot his name. Anyway, put billboards all over the place, had this big following, and then it didn't happen. And he says, it was a miscalculation. It's going to be 6 months from now. It didn't happen then either. Imagine that. Camping. Forget the guy's name. But anyway, no, they don't quit. You know, they just keep on going like nothing happened. Matthew 24, 42 through 44. Jesus said, watch therefore, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come. But know this, that if the goodman of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would have not have suffered his house to be broken up. Jesus said, you don't know. Therefore be ye also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not the Son of Man comes. You want to know when he's going to come? Whenever you don't think he's going to come. That's when he's going to come. So if you say, I think he's going to come now, I can guarantee you he's going to come another time, because he said he's going to come when you don't think he's going to come. Why people predict the second coming of Christ is beyond me with words like this. Look at Mark 13, 32. Mark 13, 32. They say, well, he just said the hour. I'm not predicting the hour, right? I'll answer that one in just a minute. Mark 13, 32 through 35. But of that day and that hour knoweth no man. No, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father. Take ye heed, watch and pray, for ye know not when the time is. The day, the hour, the time, you don't know, Jesus said. For the Son of Man is as a man taking a far journey, who left his house and gave authority to his servants and to every man his work, and commanded the porter to watch. Watch ye therefore, for ye know not when the master of the house cometh, at even, or at midnight, or at the cock crowing, or in the morning, lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping. And what I say unto you, I say unto all, watch. Don't calculate, watch. Jesus himself, in his humanity, did not know the date of his return. Verse 32. Mark 13, but of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels which are in heaven, the angels don't even know, neither the Son, but the Father. Jesus Christ in his humanity did not know when he was going to return. How presumptuous is it for a man to claim to know something that Jesus didn't know? And that Jesus flat out told you, you can't know. Now, some try to avoid the plain statements of Jesus here by not setting a specific day, but rather choosing a day as an outer limit before which Jesus will return. I'm not saying I know the day, but it's not going to happen after this particular day. We got this space of time here, and it's going to happen sometime in this space of time, and it won't happen after this day. There's a couple of problems with this. Firstly, the Bible says that not only don't we know the day and the hour, we don't even know the times and the seasons of Christ's return. Look at 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 through 2. 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 through 2. Paul says, he's talking about the second coming. We just read about it there in the last part of 1 Thessalonians 4. But of the times and the seasons, brethren, ye have no need that I write unto you. Why don't they have need to be written to? Because they already know that they don't know. For yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so cometh as a thief in the night. Do you know when the thief's coming? That's what Jesus taught. You don't know. The whole point is, if you knew when the thief was coming, you'd be ready, right? But you don't know. So Paul says that the times and the seasons of the second coming, I don't need to write you because you already know it's going to come as a thief in the night. It's unknown. What do? You watch and be ready. Not calculate. A season is a time, period, or occasion. It is a particular time or period during which something happens or which is defined by some characteristic feature or circumstance. So therefore, no man knows the time or the period of time when Christ will return. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I don't know, a teenager, I suppose, and I remember hearing a preacher in church saying that. And this was, what would that have been, 20 years ago or so, at least. And he says, I am thoroughly convinced the Lord's coming back within the next 10 years. Well, guess what? He was wrong. At least he wasn't making some kind of a prophecy or something, but he was wrong. But he's looking around, oh, things are really bad. Christ is coming back, right? Just because things are really bad doesn't mean he's coming back. Things have been really bad for a long time. Things were really bad in the Middle Ages, whenever Christians were being murdered by the millions. Things were really bad in the early 20th century, whenever the Soviet Union was murdering people by the tens of millions. Things were really bad in World War I, whenever millions and millions of people died. World War II, right? Things have been really bad for a long... Things have always been really bad. Jesus said, when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, don't conclude that the time is nigh. Just because things are bad doesn't mean he's coming back tomorrow, or in 10 years, or in 20 years. You don't know. Watch. Don't calculate. If you think that we can know the time period or the season of Christ's return, then please tell me with confidence and authority when specifically that period takes place or when we are in it. I mean, if you say, oh, we can know the times and the seasons, okay, tell me. Are we in the times and the seasons? Is it the season of the second coming? Yes or no? Tell me with authority. Are we or are we not? How would I know if we are? And if we are, how long does the season last? Right? If the season lasts for the next 10,000 years, then you didn't really tell me much, did you? Right? We're in the last times. We know that, right? We've been in the last times for 2,000 years. So you got to get specific. If you know the times and the seasons, then tell me. Definitely. Right here it is. The next X amount of years. I'm certain of it. And if you can't do that, then you don't know the times and the seasons of Christ's return. Now, secondly, if we make it to the day before the outer limit, then we know the day of Christ's return. Let me explain. Let me give you a for instance. Let's say that someone does some calculations and concludes that Jesus will return no later than December 31st, 2050. Okay? He says, I've done these calculations, however that would work, and I have determined, from the scriptures that the end of the world will be no later than the end of 2050. December 31st, 2050, it will be no later than that. Christ will return by that date. And then this person is going to justify their unbiblical prediction by saying, well, I'm not setting a day, right? I'm not telling you the day he's going to return. I'm just giving you the outer limit. Okay, let's think about that. Let's think about that. What if time goes on until December 30th, 2050? What if we get to December 30th, 2050? Guess what? If that man is right about his prediction, guess what? We know the date of Christ's return, right? When is Christ's return? If we are in December 30th, 2050, when is Christ's return? We know it absolutely. Tomorrow! He's going to come back before, on or before December 31st, right? And guess what that makes Jesus? A false prophet, because Jesus said nobody knows, but now we know. It's tomorrow, right? Think about that. Now, if the man is wrong and Christ doesn't come on December 31st, 2050, then that man is a false prophet. You see? Either Jesus is a false prophet or the man is a false prophet. Now, I know Jesus isn't a false prophet, so what's that leave you? The man's a false prophet. Or if it happened before December 31st, 2050, he got lucky, right? So either he's a false prophet, either Jesus is a false prophet, or else he just got lucky, right? And if you stretch the time out long enough, chances are you're going to get lucky. I think he's going to come back before 3000 AD. Well, yeah, I'm certain of it. I've done some calculations in the Bible. Before 3000 AD, he's going to come back. Well, yeah, thanks for all the helpful information. Date setting is therefore a very dangerous business. You run the risk of being a false prophet. You run the risk of condemning yourself. You are flying right in the face of what Jesus said, that no man knows the day nor the hours. And Paul said even the times and the seasons, we don't know because it comes as a thief in the night. Now, some will not explicitly set a date for Christ's return, but they will teach that the saints will be resurrected or raptured at a specific time before the return of Christ, usually 3.5 years or 7 years. Right? They'll say that Christ is going to come back and he's going to rapture out the saints 3.5 years or 7 years before the end of the world, right? Before the final judgment. Well, this too is date setting. And you say, well, how so? Because they haven't pointed to a date. They haven't told me when it's going to happen. Could happen tomorrow or could happen 100 years from now. It's date setting, and I'll show you why. Because if this teaching is true, then when the saints are resurrected or when they're raptured, everyone will know that the return of Christ is exactly 3.5 years away or exactly 7 years away. So let's say somebody says that the Bible teaches that the saints are going to be raptured out of this earth 3.5 years before Christ returns to destroy the earth. Okay, so let's say the guy's right. He's wrong, but let's say he's right. And we go along and all of a sudden, poof, Left Behind happens. All the saints are gone. And those that are left say, oh, well, I guess I know when the end of the world is. 3.5 years from today. What did Jesus say? No man knows the day or the hour. You see? Don't set dates. Just watch. That's what Jesus said. Just watch. Quit calculating. You're going to be wrong. You're going to make a fool of yourself. Or worse. Now, let me just summarize this study for you here in a couple of minutes and we'll be done. I just want to draw your attention to what we covered over the last year, and it's not going to take a year, believe me, thankfully. So we had the first war in heaven happen right after the creation week. God created everything good and very good, and then Satan falls some point after that, and then he brings down Adam and Eve with him. He goes and tempts the woman, and then she convinces the man, and he eats and brings sin and death into the world. So Satan has won a major battle. Then you got Cain and Abel, and Cain's a child of the devil, so Satan knows that the seed of the woman is going to come and bruise his head. So Eve is going to have a child, a descendant, that is going to bruise his head, and he's already got Cain, so he knows the only one it could be at this point is Abel, so he kills Abel. Right? Then he uses the sons of God, the fallen angels, to go into human women and populate the earth with these half-breeds, these giants, and filled the earth full of wickedness. God flooded the whole thing, killed them all. Right, killed them all but Noah and his seven family members. Satan's back to square one. Then he gathers all men together again and creates his first you know, basically world empire, the Tower of Babel. Everybody's one language. They build this tower to heaven, want to make a name for themselves. God says, no way. He scatters them all abroad, confuses their language. That was another blow in Satan's war. Then God calls out a man named Abraham, and he makes the promise to Abraham that through him, all the families of the earth will be blessed. And this is pretty obvious that this is a prophecy of the Messiah, right? So he goes after Abraham, tries to get Abraham to lie, right? A couple different times. That didn't work. Then the promised son Isaac comes, and the same promise is made to him. God goes after Isaac. Isaac does the same thing, lies about his wife, and Satan tries to get him put away. Then Jacob comes along, the promise is given to him. Then Judah, Jacob's son. And then through that, you get the nation of Israel. And Satan then focuses his energies on the nation of Israel. Then a man named David comes along, and David is a prophecy is made that the Son of God and the Messiah would come through David. So now Satan knows he needs to focus on David. And what happens? All of a sudden, David sees some woman bathing on her roof, and he commits adultery, which should have ended up in his death. Right? That would have put a stop to the royal lineage right there. God put away David's sin. And David also got himself in trouble with numbering the people and other things that Satan tried. And that was specifically even said that Satan tempted David to get him to number the people. So I'm not even speculating there. Then you got Solomon, whom the promise is made through. And Solomon marries all these foreign women, and outlandish women cause him to sin and go into idolatry. The Lord tried to destroy him. And then you got through Solomon, you got all the kings of Judah, and you get down to Joash, and this wicked woman, Athaliah, killed the whole seed royal, killed every single baby boy in the royal line, except for one. She missed one, Joash. Little boy, 6 years old. Or was he? I forget. No, he was only one or two, I think, and they kept him in the... I think he was two, and they kept him in the temple for 6 years. Brought him out when he was eight, if I remember right. So anyway, Satan almost had the royal line all killed, but Joash was preserved. Then we fast forward a few hundred years, and Christ finally comes. And then all hell breaks loose. The devils are unleashed. Israel is a whole nation full of devils and trying to oppose Christ at every turn. The Pharisees try to oppose him. They try to kill him numerous ways. They plot and connive. And eventually, they end up crucifying him. But God raises him from the dead. So Satan thinks he's won the war. He didn't win the war. God raised him from the dead, and that was actually Satan's undoing. Christ then binds Satan. Now Satan is bound. He can't deceive the nations anymore, but he can go out and cause a lot of trouble because he still has liberty like people do when they're bound. And he persecutes the early church, and he killed James, and he put Peter in prison, and he killed Stephen, and all the apostles eventually the majority of them except for John were all killed. And then he corrupts the word of God written by the apostles there in the first century. Then he goes on to create the Roman Catholic Church, a phony church, to not only confuse people about what the real church is, but also an organization to persecute the true church, which it did for hundreds of years. Then Satan floods the world with modern Bible versions. We learned about that in the 1800s. And then Satan creates his counterfeit nation of Israel as a counterfeit of what God's ancient nation was, and he manages to trick the majority of Christians into believing that this is God's nation that we have to support, and they're waiting for this Messiah to come and set up this kingdom in Israel, and they're just, I mean, it's all set up for the Antichrist to come. Then the man of sin is revealed towards right at the end, and the beast, the whole government system, one world government, religion, military, all that stuff, the mark of the beast, all men are worshiping him, and then Satan finally closes in on the church in the last final battle, and just as he's ready to destroy them all, Jesus Christ comes back and destroys him with the brightness of his coming and casts him into the lake of fire. And then, I didn't talk about this, but then we shall spend eternity with God in the new heavens and in the new earth forever, enjoying our Lord Jesus Christ. And that, my brethren, is the end. Amen.